Hey guys, welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my website is also scotthorton.org. Find all my stuff there. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 on the weekdays here. Today's show will be Pat Buchanan and Reza Marashi. Now, with Pat, obviously, we got to talk about Netanyahu some, but mostly I want to hear him on the Cold War with Ukraine, or, you know, with Russia over Ukraine and all that. But then with Reza, we're going to really get into it about the nuclear program and Netanyahu's talk this morning in Congress and all of that. All right. Oh, I need to check my email. The website is scotthorton.org. That's where I keep all the articles I ever wrote, all the interviews I ever did, more than 3,600 of them now going back to 2003. Whole show archives, at least going back to 2010 or so. I never used to post those because I was kind of embarrassed. Oh. But anyway, they're all up there going back to like at least 2010 or something. And what else I got there? I got some documentaries you might want to look at. Not that I made any of them, just linking to them. I got a chat room, which, you know, is a nice place, man. You got the usual suspects hanging out in there. That's scotthorton.org/chat. scotthorton.org/chat. And you might want to hang out in there during the show. Talk with the boys and girls. And soon. Oh, there's a short link. Oh, you're going to have to email me that short link. Email me short link, please. Yeah, yeah, it's a live radio show. I can write emails while I'm hosting it. Check it out, man. Today's the day. Kickstarter.com/a bunch of stuff. The Scott Horton Show to publish 3,500 interviews to YouTube by Matt Perry. The goal is $675. That helps take care of the cost of the rewards that you get and all of that. $675 we're trying to raise so that we can get this level 25 computer genius named Carlos to go through and put all of my interview archives on YouTube, which maybe that sounds easy or something. That sounds easy if you're a level 1 computer genius like me, or if you're a level 20 computer genius. But everybody else knows it's very difficult to get it right, and especially with the quantity of content and all this. And so here's what the goal is. Here's what the plan is. We got to raise $675. Did I say 25 or 75? 75. We got to raise $675. And then what's going to happen is this guy Carlos is going to go through and he's going to compare antiwar.com/radio with scotthorton.org/interviews. And he's going to make sure that everything at the former is also at the latter. Anything missing, we'll update all that. Then he's got to go through and he's got to make sure every single MP3 link works. And any MP3 link that doesn't work, he's got to let me know. I got to get all those updated, uploaded if I can find them. And get the archive, make sure the archive is completely complete. And then he's got to figure out how to write a script that will scrape every last blog entry at scotthorton.org/interviews, which is, again, more than 3,600 of them, scrape all the titles correctly, scrape all the MP3 links correctly, scrape all the summaries of the interviews correctly, and then have that all transferred to YouTube with the logo for the video, and have them all uploaded in chronological order because YouTube won't let you drag and drop the order because I don't know what. That's an edict from who that you're not allowed to do that. I don't know. Has to be in order. And so he's got to start way back with Alan Bach, April 9th or 12th or whichever it was, 2003, and go all the way through. And then hopefully the extra bonus whipped cream and cherry on top would be if he can make it where with each new interview entry at scotthorton.org/interviews, it also gets automatically posted up to YouTube. That's like the extra credit bonus thing that I really hope happens. But none of this is going to happen without you. And I know it's still antiwar.com fund drive, and you need to donate to them. I know it's still, it's KPFK fund drive still, I think, and you need to donate to them too. But this one is, well, I think this will help. I think the YouTube ad revenue might just help me pay my rent, which would be nice. I don't know how much better it's going to do. A lot of old stuff, you know, I don't know. But should be hopefully another extra couple of hundred few bucks, a few hundred bucks a month worth of ad revenue from them. And then also, I hope that it'll be a lot easier for people to post up YouTubes, because that's what people are used to clicking on, better than MP3 links and that kind of thing. So hopefully it'll help drive some more traffic to the site and help win over some new listeners to the show to be regular listeners and all of that. And so, you know, I don't know. That's the project. I know that, for example, Trevor Lyman at the Liberty Crier says, man, get your YouTube act together. I will embed YouTubes. I'll give you your own channel at libertycrier.com, and I'll embed YouTubes of your videos. But my people, they want YouTubes, man. They don't want to click an MP3 link. They want to click a YouTube, even if it's just a still shot of your logo on the YouTube. Give them a YouTube, he insisted. And so, okay, there we go. That hopefully will be easier to pass around on Twitter, on Facebook. Hopefully help recruit some new listeners to the show. So those of you listening live, most of you consider yourselves the hardcore fans of the show. However hard your core is, you like it more than the others anyway. So dig deep. Check it out. We got, let's see, the short link here is sky.link/Kickstarter. Oh, good, and he's going to make one on my domain, so it'll hopefully it'll be like scotthorton.org/Kickstarter or something like that. But for right now, go to sky1.link/Kickstarter, sky1.link/Kickstarter, and that will forward you on to the new Kickstarter campaign to try to get the entire Scott Horton Show Anti-War Radio interview archive up there on YouTube, where hopefully the rest of the world can see it. So, what do you think, chat room? Does that sound like a worthwhile project? It's certainly been brought up to me numerous times that it's something that I absolutely got to hurry up and get around to. So, you know, if you pledge $10 or more, let's see. Yeah, we got a thing here. If you pledge $10 or more, you get a nice thank you on the show. If you pledge $25, you get Philip Drew Administrator by Colonel Edward Mandel House. If you pledge $50, you get The Jihadi's Return by Patrick Coburn. If you pledge $125 or more, you get a thanks on the show, a 1 ounce QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And if you pledge $250 or more, you get a thanks on the show, a web ad on scotthorton.org for a month if you want, or 5 copies of The Jihadi's Return by Patrick Coburn. And then if you pledge $500 or more, then you pretty much take care of the whole goddamn thing, and then you get all of the above. So those are your little rewards for pledging and helping and whatever. And we're doing this on a short time frame, too. We got it set for just 2 weeks because, hey, what the hell? We ought to be able to raise $675 in 2 weeks, right? Don't you think? 14 days to go. So to get there, just go to sky1.link/Kickstarter, sky1.link/Kickstarter. And, yeah, there you go. Make your pledge today if you can do it. I think it's a worthwhile thing. Let me see, chat room guys. You say anything, chat room guys? Number 6 in the chat room says yes. So apparently that's approval there. So number 6 is with it. So that's you guys too. So come on with it, and thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Sky 1. That's the number 1. Sky digit 1. sky1.link/Kickstarter. And I'll have a better link for you here real soon, too. Later on in the show, Pat Buchanan, Reza Marashi. I'll have some things to say about Benjamin Netanyahu right on the other side of these commercials. Thanks for tuning in. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, writing up a blog here about this for the YouTube Kickstarter project. And thanks very much. In fact, thanks very much. I should say this a lot more often than I do. Thanks very much to everybody who supports the show, the advertisers, all the donors, and everybody sends your kind words and all the rest of it. I really appreciate it. Sure helps make the thing possible. Don't ever doubt that. And especially, hey, you monthly subscribers. I love you guys, man. All right. So there it is. I just put out a tweet, and I just put a blog entry at scotthorton.org/stress about it as well. And so thank you in advance for your help on the project. Should be great, I hope. Let's see. Okay. Also, let me say real quick before I get to Netanyahu that Neboj Samalich is leaving antiwar.com, mostly. Neboj has been writing for antiwar.com since, I think, the year 2000. His column was called Balkan Express. Now it's Moments of Transition, and now it's gone. He's been hired by RT, and the way they've got it is... they got an exclusive deal with him, basically. So, that's it. So, you'll still be able to read Neboj Samalich, but you'll have to go to RT.com to do it. And yeah, I know that RT is financed by the Russian government, but I think that, he takes pretty much the same, I wouldn't work for him. But, you know, just for the appearance of impropriety... Obviously, they have an agenda to make America look bad, but the truth is America is bad. And if they want to give Neboj Samalich a platform to tell the truth to people and it happens to coincide with Russia's interests, well, then that's the American people's fault for allowing this government to be so evil that the Russians are right about us in any way. That's just a cross we all have to bear. But anyway, so good luck to Neboj. So we'll still be talking with him on the show. We'll still be running his articles at antiwar.com. And we don't run much RT because, hey, it's the appearance of impropriety. It appears very improper. But we'll be running Neboj Samalich, no doubt about that. So, okay, so there's that program note. And now, so on to the Netanyahu thing. I'm pleasantly surprised. I guess I thought that there was at least a possibility that he would say something important or convincing to anyone who ain't already convinced or something, but his speech writers ain't that good. I don't know if you guys saw the big to-do this morning. Now, why did he give his big joint session of Congress speech in the morning? Because it was for dinner time, prime time in Israel. That's why, because he's running for re-election in Israel. That's why. Otherwise, it'd be for prime time here. But anyway, I think that, one of the things I'd like to say about it is it seems like a pretty good argument for what the Leverett's, Flint Leverett and Hillary Mann Leverett, often said and what they argued in their book, Going to Tehran, that Obama should just get on a plane and go to Tehran, Richard Nixon to China style, and just go there and make friends and shake hands with the Ayatollah and say, you know what? We don't see eye to eye on everything, but we're ending this Cold War between our nations right now. Handshake. Blam. And then all the outstanding issues would still be outstanding, but they could be resolved in a much nicer spirit.
And the Republicans and the Israelis and everybody, they would just have to suck it if they don't like it. It would be too late. It would be just like Nixon. When Nixon went to China, you know, they said he was the only one who could because he was such a red-baiting fear-monger that only Nixon could go to China. I don't know if Obama really had that going for him. You know, like being the most anti-Islamic activist in America or something. Although he's killed more Muslims than anyone in America, really. So there's that. But anyway, point is that what the Leverett said was, if Obama just tries to do the nuclear deal, then the Israelis will screw it up. And their partisans in America will screw it up. Because there are too many other objections, real and fake, that are left withstanding. And so if you saw Netanyahu's speech this morning, you saw where he tried to include, to add as linkage, as they like to call it, every issue under the sun. Oh, so, I don't know if I want to talk about the Palestinians much, but he said, you know, they have to basically, he implied, they have to stop backing Hamas or Hezbollah at all. Otherwise, no nuclear deal could be acceptable. And, you know, the theory being that Iran is the greatest purveyor of terrorism in the world. They never really quantify that. They just claim it. He put out a cartoon map for his AIPAC speech yesterday about them being the leader of all terrorism in the world. And then, but all the marks on there are all a bunch of nonsense. The Corpus Christi, Washington, D.C. restaurant plot, the used car salesman where it was just a drug deal that included an FBI informant. Then the whole thing is completely debunked. And I had on the show, on the record, or I guess I didn't have them all on the show, but on the record, I compiled them. There were six former CIA officers who immediately came out and denounced that. That was Ray McGovern and Ray Close and Bob Baer and Michael Scheuer and Phil Giraldi and, did I say Ray McGovern? No, I said Ray McGovern. And Flint Leverett. Six former CIA officers said, oh, please, give me a break. This is such a stupid lie. But that didn't keep the war party from putting that one on the map. And then, of course, there's the Argentina attacks, which Gareth Porter has completely debunked. And then they even had the Mumbai attack and the Bucharest attack. Of course, Gareth Porter debunked both of those as well. And others, too, you know, but Gareth is the go-to guy. But anyway, hey, let's just put up a map of all accusations of any time that Iran has been accused of being behind a terror attack. And I missed this part of it, but I saw a tweet that said, did he just accuse Iran of being behind the Al-Qaeda embassy attacks? Did you guys see that? Anybody in the chat room, did you see the speech? Did he say that? I know that he did try to say that they were, you know, that Iran worked with Al-Qaeda, which is completely a lie. It's Israel that's working with Al-Qaeda right now in Syria. Everybody knows that, against Iran, which is working for Hezbollah and the Syrian government there. But, you know, he's just referring to this old debunked nonsense, just like in the Weekly Standard, where they breathlessly say, oh, my God, look, there were Al-Qaeda guys in prison in Iran. And so, oh, my God, Al-Qaeda in Iran. Doesn't matter that they were in prison there. Oh, no, that's ties. Get it? Ties. They're all tied together, get it, with ties? And anyway, when it comes to the nuclear program and Netanyahu's position on the nuclear program, it's same as ever. Any spinning centrifuge, any nuclear capability in Iran amounts to a nuclear weapons program, according to him, and it all must be abolished, and yet he doesn't have an idea how that might happen. He pretends to believe that there's a sanctions regime in the world that could make the Iranians give up their nuclear program. He doesn't believe complete and total nuclear annihilation at the hands of Israeli and American H-bombs is enough to deter them from using one simple atom bomb, if they have one. But he does believe that sanctions are enough to make him do exactly what's demanded of him in giving up the nuclear program altogether. And he has no other explanation. Not one that makes sense or another one that doesn't either. And that's pretty much it. Pat Buchanan here, just a sec.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Pat Buchanan, author of The Greatest Comeback, How Richard Nixon Rose from Defeat to Create a New Majority. That's the latest one. Before that, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, The Death of the West, Suicide of a Superpower, A Republic, Not an Empire, etc., 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 all available at Amazon, of course. Welcome back to the show, Pat. How are you doing?
Doing just fine. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Sure.
And, you know, I decided I wanted to get you on to talk about Russia and Ukraine last week, and then it just so happens I have you on just after Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to the Congress about Iran and the nuclear program this morning. So, you know, seems timely. I could bring up a question I've long wanted to ask you.
Sure.
I was just in junior high. I was a freshman in high school in the first Gulf War. And I only found out much later on even about the controversy of your statement on the McLaughlin Group back then. I don't know if it was in 1990 or in 91 during the buildup to the war, that Congress is Israeli-occupied territory. And, of course, you got yourself in a world worth of trouble over that and that kind of thing. But the point I'm trying to get to is I was just in high school, but I was paying close attention to that war in the run-up to that war and all that. And I never heard mention one of the neoconservatives, of the Israel lobby, of the Israeli government and their interest in Operation Desert Storm, the first war against Iraq back in 1991. And if I had heard you say that on the McLaughlin Group, I wouldn't have known what you were talking about. So I know about the Israel lobby and their influence these days, especially post-September 11th era and all that. But can you educate me a bit about what was going on back in 1990, 91, and how much say the Israeli lobby had over that war?
Well, it was that was not so much, you know, the statement I made that about the Israeli occupied territory, I think had to do with a vote in Congress on some legislation which was favored by the Israeli lobby. It was not exactly, I believe, the vote on the war. And that came after August. I mean, I think that
statement. Oh, I'm sorry.
Was made in June.
I misunderstood.
But that's
that.
All right. But here's it. Let me say this. There's no doubt that in the I opposed, and Robert Novak did, and we had a small group of paleo conservatives. We opposed the war because we thought, and as I argued, I said, if we go in here, it's going to be the first Arab American war. We're going to go into this region, and we're never going to get out. And what Saddam Hussein did, clearly, was an act of aggression when he seized Kuwait. And as I say, there were a number of us who opposed it, and it was astonishingly. I talked to Sam Nunn, as I recall, back then, and he opposed it himself. And I believe he felt that that vote against that war, which turned out to be a huge success, was a reason he didn't run for president in 1992, run for the Democratic nomination. So that was a very controversial issue over, but I don't think the Kuwait war had as much to do with the Israeli lobby as the, and certainly George H.W. Bush was at odds then with the Israeli government and with Yitzhak Shamir. So I think that's not exactly on target.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Well, thanks for clarifying that for me. So the comment about Israeli-occupied territory, that may have been about the actual occupied territories or something. It's not in reference to to their role in the...
Let me straighten out here. There's no doubt I called the Capitol Hill Israeli-occupied territory, but it had to do with another issue. Mm. The phrase I used on the McLaughlin Group, and I got into an argument with Mort Kondracki, who had written an editorial calling for the Americans to attack Saddam Hussein when we only had the 82nd Airborne in Saudi Arabia and the Iraqis had 200,000 troops in Kuwait, and our guys you couldn't attack with a light division against the heavy divisions, and we didn't attack for many more months, six more months. But I said the only people that want war now is the Israeli Defense Ministry and its Amen Corner in the United States. So I think the Amen Corner comment was the one that came at the time of that war.
I see. And so, well, so, and I know a little bit of the history of the the tension between the Bush senior administration and the Shamir government in Israel at the time. But
yeah, that was over loan guarantees that fall. But again, I don't know that the Israeli lobby played that big a role in the I'm certain they were in favor of the Americans going into Kuwait and smashing Saddam Hussein. They detested them, and many Americans favored that war. But again, it was something like a 52-48 vote in the Senate.
Right. So even if they played a slight role, it may have been a decisive one back then for having the vote.
I don't think so. I think that's the wrong. We're talking about the wrong war here in this sense. I knew that we were going to go to war when I heard George Bush, who I knew well, and I had that was before I ran against him, and when he said in August, after Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait early in August, as I recall, Margaret Thatcher said, "Don't go wobbly, George." A famous quote. I don't think the president liked it, but the president himself said, "This will not stand," in August. And immediately, because George Bush was a serious man, senior, when he said that, I said, "We're going, if Saddam Hussein doesn't get up and get out of Kuwait, we're going in." And when he sent, I knew that he was actually going to go in when they sent that big armored division down from Germany after the after November, and I believe after the elections of 1990. He sent that big armored division down there. The only reason for that was to move on in, and Schwarzkopf did in 1991. And then, of course, I ran against President Bush in 1992. And my goodness, that was 1992. And when the war went on, I believe. And then we did pretty well against Bush in New Hampshire, where it was not even an issue.
Right. And now, I remember reading actually fairly recently about Bob Novak complaining, your friend, fellow paleocon Bob Novak, complaining that Saddam Hussein was really trying to negotiate a way out of Kuwait if he could just save a little bit of face, but that Bush Sr. really wouldn't hear it.
I think that's, my feeling is that is right, that Saddam Hussein had gotten himself out there, and he couldn't beat the United States, and Bush put together a 28-nation coalition. They even had Hafez al-Assad in there sending 4,000 Syrian troops. The only nation over there that, incidentally, that was not part of our coalition was Jordan, the king of Jordan, because he had the real sympathies for Iraq. Inside Jordan, among the Berbers, I believe, who were loyal to the king, he declared neutrality, and I mentioned that in a recent column. But again, I don't think the overall that the Israeli lobby was as prominent an issue in the 1991 war.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the neoconservative movement? Because they're pretty much for a hawkish position between anyone and anyone, whether Israel's involved or not, right?
Well, yeah, there's no question they would be all for the war. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, you're just saying they weren't the force behind it like in 2003.
Well, they didn't have the influence in George Bush Sr.'s administration. You know, Scowcroft was national security advisor there, and Jim Baker was the Secretary of State, and he was no enthusiast of the Israelis, to be quite frank. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had some very tough statements to make about them. And so I don't think George H.W. Bush, to say that he was heavily influenced by the Israeli lobby, is a mistake.
Well, I guess I was thinking more of Congress and kind of the rest of the consensus in D.C. and that sort of thing. But anyway, I'm glad I had a chance to get you to clarify that for me.
Sure.
Now, hang on, the music's playing, but when we get back, we're going to figure out why Pat Buchanan has gone soft on Iran and the Soviet Union. I mean, Russia. Right after this.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, talking with Pat Buchanan about the Israel lobby and American foreign policy. And now, so, Pat, tell me, are you in favor of this Iran nuclear deal that Obama's negotiating?
Well, I am in favor of a negotiated solution to the Iranian nuclear program. I would answer that yes. I hope it's a good, solid deal. And I think a good deal is certainly better than no deal, because I think that would put us on the road to more sanctions, confrontation, and possibly war.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I mean, we all know that you're a conservative, Republican, American, patriotic type, and yet you seem to be, separating yourself from the conservative consensus here, that this deal is a bad deal and it's worse than no deal, and that we're setting up our friends, the Israelis, to be annihilated at the hands of Iranian nuclear warfare. You don't believe that hype?
No, I just don't concur with that. Some of the arguments are that, you know, the Ayatollah Khomeini is basically this wild radical Islamist who is desperate to get an atom bomb, and when he does, he'll immediately drop it on Israel. But that would lead to the immediate annihilation of Iran. The Israelis have some 200 nuclear weapons. That's the average amount people agree that they've got. I don't think they're going to do that. I think the Iranians want a deal, both to get the sanctions lifted. I'm not sure they want a nuclear weapon right now, or that they want a nuclear weapon. Our own intelligence agency, as well as Mossad, have said that they do not see evidence that the Iranians intend to enrich uranium to the 90% needed for a bomb. They have never done so. They have given up their 20% uranium. I think the Iranians they're very tough-minded, they're brutal, and they've got a bad track record, but I think they see themselves correctly in an era of peace in the Gulf, no war with the Americans, certainly, as because they're the largest country there, the most populous country there, the most advanced there, and they've got a new ally thanks to George W. Bush in Baghdad. They see themselves as becoming the dominant power in the Persian Gulf down the road, and the leader of the Shia world, certainly, and a major force in the world. But to get in a war with the United States would put in peril all of that.
Mm. Yeah, it seems like their best reason to even consider nuclear weapons, Saddam Hussein, is long gone now. And boy, what a buffer do they have to their West, huh?
Well, they got a buffer to their West, and I heard Netanyahu today, and he's correct that they have a buffer in Hafez al-Assad. But Hafez al-Assad was our ally in the Gulf War, and he's Iran's ally because he's under threat of being overthrown and murdered, and he's a Shia, and he's an Alawite, and that's only about 15% of the population, and so he and Iran are allies for that reason. And as for Hezbollah in Lebanon, they also are allies of Hafez al-Assad because they are Shia as well. But, I mean, even General Rabin, when he went into Lebanon, or rather they sent Ariel Sharon into Lebanon in the early 1980s, I remember Prime Minister Rabin said, "We let the Shia genie out of the bottle." That's the origins of Hezbollah. So I see the Shia, who are about 15% of the Muslims worldwide, and their leader is clearly Iran, as much more on the defensive in the Sunni-Shia war that's in the Islamic world, in which the United States, I think, we should stay aloof. I mean, if you take a look at who is the most dangerous enemy to the United States of America, that's the way I look at it. And Al-Qaeda took down the Twin Towers, and Al-Qaeda has done most of these terrorist attacks in the West. And they're number one, and I would put ISIS now as trying to rival them, and ISIS is number two. But in that particular conflict, as even Bibi Netanyahu said, Iran is the enemy of our enemy, but he says Iran is still our enemy. Well, we certainly are not going to fight both sides in Iraq and both sides in Syria. And if you have to pick and choose, I mean, I would prefer the present government of Iraq to ISIS and the present government of Syria to ISIS. And so that's why I don't share the the view that we ought to be at war with either. We should not be at war with the regime in Damascus.
All right, and now people, in case you're young and you're not familiar, Pat Buchanan worked for Richard Nixon and for Ronald Reagan, and that means that you were in the Reagan administration just after the Iranian Revolution and when anti-Iranian tensions were at their very highest. So we would be naive to think that you were naive about the revolutionary Islamist government in Tehran.
Well, certainly, I mean, they took our people hostage. And under Jimmy Carter, and frankly, they let him. When did they let him go? It's when Ronald Reagan raised his hand to take the oath, because they assumed, I think quite correctly, that they would have been given a 48-hour ultimatum, and if and to turn our people loose. And if they hadn't, I think President Reagan would have blockaded them, or could have blockaded them. And then if they murdered our hostages, which they could have done, 52 American diplomats. I think Karg Island would have gone up in flames. So, but Iran clearly was, it came into power, one of its raison d'etre, its very reason for being, was to confront the great Satan and the United States of America. But this was 35 years ago, and I think Iran sees its interest now in the region in a different light, and I think they do want a deal. And I'm willing to look at a deal. I don't want eternal enmity between us and Iran. I was there when Richard Nixon, I was in China with Richard Nixon when 20 years after Mao Zedong was, you know, killing American soldiers in Korea and brainwashing our prisoners.
Yeah. Now, in the chat room, they're insisting I call you out on the October surprise there and the deal made to release the hostages before Reagan was even inaugurated. What do you say to that, Pat?
You mean the October surprise? You mean they released the hostages before Reagan took the oath of office as President of the United States? What do you mean in terms of an October surprise? Everybody was talking about an October surprise, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, the reporting is, and I don't have it all in front of me, but that they had already made a deal with the Iranians to not release the hostages until Reagan was inaugurated.
I don't believe that. I mean, I've heard the reports. I mean, the vice president-elect, or George Bush or somebody flew to Paris and cut a deal.
That's what they said.
I don't believe it.
No? All right. All right, now, so let me ask you about America's relationship with Russia right now. It seems like the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine is more or less holding. And some of the statements of the Germans and the French as they were going to make this deal, they seem to be, you know, putting normal political politeness aside. And they're pretty blunt about how the narrative of Russian aggression here is wrong. And we want to put an end to this conflict right now. And so my question for you is, do you think that's going to stick? Are European allies' interests in peace in Eastern Europe, is that going to take precedence over, American adventurism at this point, do you think?
I think the French and the Germans do want a deal. They do want a truce. I think a truce would be a good thing. There have been something close to 6,000 dead in this war of secession in the Donbass. And I hope it sticks, because I think if it goes on and on, the result is going to be more dead Ukrainians, both rebels and loyalists, and not only soldiers but civilians as well. And if it spikes upward, I do think that the Russians could take Mariupol and get a land bridge to Crimea. So I think the truth is that Ukraine cannot defeat Russia. I mean, this is very close to Russian territory. The Russians could support the rebels. They got fine equipment. They could put people in there. And so I think the idea of Ukraine taking on Russia or a Russian proxy in that region is fruitless, and I don't think people should die in that cause. And so I'm glad to see the Minsk II agreement seem to be holding right now, and I hope it does hold, because I'll tell you, Ukraine's in horrendous shape economically. Their currency last year lost 70% of its values. I think it's lost about 40% of it this year alone, and the people are suffering terribly. And this idea of increased sanctions on Russia and then have the Russians sanction Ukraine so that both of them become economic crises, I don't think that's a hopeful sign for all of Europe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, well, so what about Putin? Who is this guy to you? Because everybody else says that he's trying to create at least the old Tsarist empire, if not the old Soviet one. And his aggression must be checked or else he's going to run roughshod over us all.
Well, I mean, look, Putin he's got the Crimea back and he's got the Russified sections of the Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk. But, you know, if you talk about recreating the Russian empire of the Tsars, you're talking about going in and recapturing all the Baltic republics. You're talking about recapturing Bielorussia, or Belarus, as they call it now, Kazakhstan, and, you know, Uzbekistan, all these other areas. I don't for a second believe that Vladimir Putin has that in mind. I simply don't believe it. Now, they say that you can recreate the Soviet empire. You really think he's going to be back on the Elbe River? I just don't believe it. I think Putin is reacting to events as they happen. I don't think he's got some grand strategy. I think he's enraged by the fact that the Americans took advantage of him, moved NATO into the Warsaw Pact countries and then into the three Soviet republics of the Baltic states. The Americans tried to move NATO into Moldova and Georgia and Ukraine. He feels crowded. He feels we're on his doorstep. He doesn't like what we did in Libya when he authorized Americans to strike to defend the folks in Benghazi. I think he feels that Russia has been taken advantage of horribly when they held out their hand of friendship after the Cold War. And I think he's not without a point.
All right. Now, I'm sorry I'm keeping you over just a couple of minutes here, but I want to give you a chance to talk real quick about your latest piece, which is running today on antiwar.com. Best of times or worst of times? What's your point here?
Well, the point is, Kerry made a statement saying, you know, these are something like we've never been safer than we are now, and fewer people being dying and fewer things happening negatively. And we all look out the world, and it looks like it's coming apart. And then Mr. Clapper, the national security man, the intelligence man, he comes out and said there's been more terrorist attacks or twice as many last year as the year before, which is also true. But as I point out, the 20th century was a century of horrendous wars and massacres and slaughters. I mean, 30,000 died at the hands of 30 million at the hands of Stalin, maybe 50 million at the hands of Mao Zedong. We had World War I and World War II, two of the bloodiest wars in all of human history. And you had all these great, millions dying in Burundi and Rwanda and in Ethiopia and in Nigeria. And so what I'm saying is, compared to that horrendous years when we were growing up, what is happening in Iraq and Syria is bad, but it is nothing like Hitler's Reich or Stalin's USSR or Tojo's Imperial Japan and all the death and destruction wrought by those regimes and wrought, frankly, by the allies in liberating countries from those regimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not calling you that old, Pat. I know you're not, but what about, can you compare it all from what you know? I know you know your history so well, about the level of fear of the American people relative to the threat.
Well, that's a very good point, because, I mean, we see Jihadi John in this horrible beheading of these couple of journalists and aid workers, innocent people. Then we see the Christians on the beach being beheaded. And this is on television. It's on these, phone cameras. It's on Instagram and all these social media, as they call it. And it's constantly on cable TV. And so people are talking about ISIS, which is a dreadful, dreadful organization. And it is a death cult of sorts, a militant Islam. But it's not a threat, existential threat, to the United States of America. The Turks apparently don't consider it a threat because they could go in there and annihilate ISIS in a matter of a month. They got an army of 500,000 men, 3,000 tanks, 1,000 helicopters and fighter bombers and fighter planes. And they could go in no time at all and finish these folks off. And they don't do it because they don't consider it that grave a threat. And secondly, some of these Sunni nations in the Persian Gulf, like the Saudis and others in Qatar, basically have been, as Joe Biden was right when he said they've been, you know, they were initially aiding these people because they're Sunni. And they all look at the conflict as a Sunni-Shia conflict, and they're anti-Iran and anti-what's going on in Baghdad and anti-Assad. So they see them as de facto allies. And so there's going on in the Middle East, all these folks have their own fish to fry, and they tilt to various sides, none of whom is very attractive. But my point is, I don't want another army of Americans getting all cut up and bloodied up trying to win wars which aren't our wars but are their wars.
All right, and with that, I'll let you go. Thanks very much for your time, Pat. I sure appreciate it.
Sure. You take it easy.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. All right, y'all. That's the great Pat Buchanan. He's at antiwar.com/Pat. His last few articles are Best of Times or Worst of Times, The Ultimate Enemy of ISIS, Whose Job Is It to Kill ISIS, U.S.-Russia Clash in Ukraine, The Persians Are Coming. And, of course, check out all his great books at Amazon.com. The latest is The Greatest Comeback, and we'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. So that was cool, man. I kept Pat over time a little bit there, asked him more things. I hope I didn't get too bogged down asking the same question over and over in the first section there. Did I sound like a jackass? Asked and answered. Guess I just misunderstood the whole damn concept. What do I know? Anyway, yeah, the Amen Corner. That's what I was thinking of. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I like Pat. I think I might have made him angry. By the end of the thing, he was like, okay, bye. No, I don't know. Maybe not. He's all right. Anyway, Reza Mirashi's coming up in just a few. He's on the run trying to get back to his phone. We'll give him a few minutes here. So listen, I already got three backers for the new Kickstarter. And he sent me a link. Where am I? Matt. Nope, that's not it. This one? Yeah. ScottHorton.org/kickstart. Can't beat that. ScottHorton.org/kickstart. And I've already got three people there. Oh, I guess you got to click one more link from there. Whatever. Anyway. Already got $135 pledged towards our $675 goal. So you can be like those three and also pledge money. The goal is to raise $675 so I can hire a computer genius who will put all the archives onto the YouTube for me. And so it's a huge thing. It's a huge thing, and I need your help, and so I really appreciate your help, and so thank you very much for helping. That's ScottHorton.org/kickstart. ScottHorton.org/kickstart. Raising $675. That ain't too bad, right? You can do that. You can help. All right, cool. Now, a guy just emailed me, on the Twitter here. He Twittered me is what he did. He tweeted to me. If you only had one article you could share with people about the myth of Iranian nuclear weapons threat, what would it be? Oh, you're killing me, man. You know, the thing of it is, Sterling is the guy's name. Sterling, here's the problem, man, is that all the best articles are by Gareth Porter, but you need to read 100 of them. And all the other best articles are by Gordon Prather, but you need to read 100 of them. And who in the world ever wrote the single best article on Iran's nuclear program? The single best one. Oh, you know what? Probably something by Mohammed Sahimi. Probably something by Mohammed Sahimi. Yeah, that guy is a brilliant genius, great writer. But anyway, so I sent him a link to an essay that I wrote back in 2010 called Reality Check, Iran is not a nuclear threat for the Christian Science Monitor. And there's one error in here, but it's really not my fault. Man, I tried to explain it to the guy, and it was the editor screwed me up, and then I finally made him fix it. But then the way that the editor's note is, it doesn't say, hey, editor, due to an editor's error or anything like that. It makes it look like I'm the one who screwed it up, but I was trying to differentiate between what is the mandate of the safeguards agreement and what is the mandate of the extra Security Council resolutions on the IAEA demanding that they investigate these, those, and the other claims have nothing to do with the safeguards agreement. Anyway, the article is right. Whatever was wrong is fixed anyway. And cool, man, I actually haven't read this thing in a while. But I'm totally right about it. And that was back in 2010. And the only thing that's different is that since then, Gareth Porter has written a book called Manufactured Crisis. And that's the real answer to your question. If I only had one article about Iran's nuclear program, Sterling, it's the book Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. In fact, if you want, man, go back to the archives from right around a year ago, and I interviewed him, one interview per chapter, and we went through every single point of fact in that damn book on this show. I interviewed him once a week for 10 weeks in a row or some crap like that. And in fact, you can even find the whole 3-hour-long interview or something, too. Maybe more than that. But, yeah, I mean, otherwise, I can just tell you right now that the deal is they never had a nuclear weapons program. The worst you could say is some parts of the Iranian government did some research into some aspects of nuclear weaponization back before 2003, none of which led anywhere, and none of which was part of a single nuclear weapons program mandate from the Supreme Leader to go ahead and do that. And, in fact, he not only said, I disapprove of this project, he said it was against Islam to pursue weapons of mass destruction. And so everybody knock it off. That was the chemical and nuclear weapons too. And again, Gareth Porter, the great Gareth Porter, it was one of the best articles at Foreign Policy all last year at foreignpolicy.com when the Ayatollah said no to nukes. A great one there. But the deal is, anyone can understand this, okay? Here's the basic regime. It's so simple, all right? Iran is a sovereign state. They signed up to this treaty voluntarily back in the days when their government was a sock puppet of ours. But the current regime since 79 has stayed within this deal. They signed up for the non-proliferation treaty, which means that they promise never to get nukes, never to make them, never to try and buy them. They also have their right to peaceful nuclear technology guaranteed by that very same treaty. And in fact, America's even mandated to get rid of our nukes and to help them with their non-weaponization nuclear projects, their peaceful nuclear projects. So never mind that America's in violation of both ends of our deal, and we won't even respect the fact that they're living up to theirs. But anyway, what that means, when they signed that non-proliferation treaty, they agreed to then hire the IAEA to make a deal with the IAEA called a safeguards agreement that allows the IAEA to verify their nuclear program and the quantity and quality of their nuclear material at every step. They are already safeguarded. They are already within the treaty. They've never been found to be outside of the non-proliferation treaty. They've never violated their safeguards agreement. You can find a couple of times where you hear a bunch of hype, like when Barack Obama pretended to out the COM facility in early October 2000 and or was it late October 2000? Yeah, it was late October 2009. After Iran had declared it 4 days earlier, and he said, oh, no, look, a secret hole in the ground. Well, they're not mandated to even tell the IAEA about their hole in the ground until they're within 6 months from introducing nuclear material. So they weren't in violation of the agreement at all. People wanted to quibble. Seriously, they were quibbling about whether subsidiary arrangement 0.133, or was it 1.33, or whatever the crap, said that, no, as soon as you imagine that you might want to start digging a hole in the ground, you got to notify us then. But that was part of the additional protocol, the safeguards agreement, that had never been ratified by the Iranian parliament and was only a good faith measure during negotiations with the European three, the E3, France, Britain, and Germany, 2003 through 5. So in 2009, they weren't banned by that, or they weren't under the mandate of subsidiary arrangement 1.33. And anyway, that's the best you got? Get the hell out of here. They've got a civilian uranium enrichment program. They have a heavy water reactor that will produce very polluted, unusable plutonium that the Russians will have to harvest the spent fuel out of the damn thing for them anyway. And they don't have a reprocessing facility that could clean up of any description, that could even try, that could even attempt to clean up that plutonium and use it. They don't know how to implode a bomb. They need years worth of tests, millions and millions of tens or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure and research in order to figure out how to make an implosion bomb. And they just can't divert any of their nuclear material without the IAEA knowing. So when this entire agreement expires, assuming Obama gets it, and the agreement expires at the end of 10 years, they're still under a safeguards agreement. They still have the IAEA monitoring everything they do. And now Netanyahu said, yeah, but the DPRK broke out from under their agreement. Yeah, but why? Because George Bush broke the deal first and put them under a bunch of extra sanctions. Forced them out. That's North Korea. DPRK is North Korea. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. You know, this article I wrote for the Christian Science Monitor 5 years ago, Reality Check, Iran No Nuclear Threat, I think holds up rather well. Anyway, on the line is our friend Reza Marashi, formerly of the State Department, but now he works for the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. And I really like these guys, Trita Parsi and them, working for peace between America and Iran. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Reza?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. So tell me, were you very impressed by Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech to the U.S. Congress this morning?
I mean, I think that he gave a charismatic speech that had a lot of sound bites. That doesn't mean I was impressed, though. I thought it was a deeply ideological speech that shows just how out of step he is with mainstream American public opinion.
Mm. All right. Well, now on the facts, was there any real challenge to your position in there that you thought, you know, he does kind of have a good point there about, you know, the vulnerabilities of this deal for, you know, whatever kind of problems, anything?
No, not at all, because diplomacy is not about getting everything that you want. It's about finding out where areas of commonality exist and areas of divergence exist, so that compromise becomes possible. The idea is both sides, the U.S. and Iran, have decided that getting some of what they want, but not everything that they want, is better than the alternative, which is getting really nothing that you want and a war becoming increasingly likely.
Mm-hmm. And now, you know, that seems to be a big part of the talking points of both sides on this thing as I watch the debates go back and forth. And, you know, believe me, I know that the neoconservatives really have always had Iran as their top target in mind, and that there are a lot of people who would like to not stop until they get their regime change. But then I see the peaceniks, too, saying, oh, you know, if we don't get this deal, this could really lead to war. But it seems like that really is conceding the false premise that if we don't get this deal, that the Iranians are going to break out and go ahead and try to make nuclear weapons at some point, and then we'll have to bomb them. Because really, if the deal fails and we're left with the status quo is a safeguarded civilian nuclear program. Who cares?
Well, that yes and no, maybe, but and I disagree. In all likelihood, no. I think that if there's no deal, then the United States is going to ramp up sanctions and other forms of pressure, secret assassination, cyber warfare, all things that we've seen in recent years prior to President Rouhani being elected in 2013. So if the United States chooses to escalate, that escalation does not happen in a vacuum. The Iranians will respond to pressure with pressure. That is what the track record shows. So they, in turn, will respond by systematically advancing the technical aspects of their nuclear program. This cycle of escalation nearly spiraled into a war not very long ago, back in 2012. So we know what the track record looks like. We don't have to look very far back in our recent past, and that's what makes the status quo unsustainable if the talks break down.
Right. Yeah, and the fact that it's a safeguarded civilian nuclear program has never had anything to do with it anyway, as far as the narrative on the American or Israeli side. They just characterize it however they want to. And of course, it's pretty easy to understand. The average guy doesn't know anything about nuclear or anything, so if you just say the word nuclear, you're basically right there saying, defer to an expert here, and then TV will have an expert for you to defer to. And so who's going to figure this out for themselves when it's such a complicated issue? That's really what it comes down to. So, yeah, I mean, you're right, I guess. They could just sit there and, you know, Scott Ritter wrote a thing way back in 2005 saying what looks like plan A, plan B, and plan C for how to negotiate this deal, and then only plan C would be finally to go to war, that really that's a smokescreen. Really, it's just step one, two, and three. We've got to pretend to go through all of the motions of negotiating this thing as best we can before we say C. They're absolutely incorrigible, and now we have no choice but war. So I could see that narrative kicking right in if these talks fail. Of course, even if it's the Americans' fault, 60-40 or 70-30, they're still going to blame the Iranians for the talks failing. And then that, I see what you mean. That could be the beginning of a whole new push for violence.
Yeah, I mean, if the talks break down, God forbid, then the likelihood of war increases exponentially in my view. But also you have a blame game that will start to take place. And yes, the U.S. will blame Iran and Iran will blame the U.S. irrespective of where the actual truth lies. The difference is that the United States is trying to win the blame game within global public opinion. The Iranians are just trying to win the blame game at home. They're trying to convince their people that they've done everything in their power to try to solve this issue peacefully and that the problem is in Washington, not in Tehran. But if the interesting part here is, will the rest of the international community follow suit with the United States if we decide to not cut a deal for whatever reason? Because I think that numerous world leaders that are at the negotiating table with the Iranians and the Americans have said that the Iranians are actually negotiating in good faith. So will they fall in line with more sanctions and an escalation of the conflict that America will spearhead, or will they decide, you know, we can de-escalate the conflict with Iran unilaterally, you know, bilaterally? Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen which one is going to play out, but that's not really a risk that either side should take when we're so close to being able to actually get a deal that's a win-win for everyone involved.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting, too, the politics in D.C. where Obama's saying yesterday that, well, you know, or I guess his spokesman, I don't know, I just read the headline. Somebody in the administration was saying, well, you know, chances are probably not even 50-50 in this kind of thing. And I could see the politics of that, wanting to play it down and how they could benefit, I guess, even if the talks fail, by saying, see, we told you we would never give in to a bad deal and that we have Israel's back or whatever. That's pretty good, democratic politics. Probably as good as saying, see, we told you we could get a reasonable deal with the Iranians and we got one, right? So I could see from a domestic politics point of view from the Obama administration, like, it might just be 50-50 either way. They don't really care whether they get the deal or not as far as that goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you just pointed out is that there are a lot of moving pieces that are playing out here. And precisely because there's a lot of moving pieces, this is why we don't negotiate in public. The negotiations have to happen behind closed doors so that the negotiators have the political space that's necessary to see what kind of flexibility and compromise can be possible. Fast forward to today, the Israeli prime minister went in front of Congress. He didn't say anything new. The whole reason why he did this was to try and blow the negotiations open into the public eye so that everybody can take a look and see what's happening. And that puts more pressure on the negotiators. It reduces their flexibility and increases the likelihood that they cannot take yes for an answer. So precisely because all of these moving pieces are so delicate and so difficult to iron out, He wants it to be done publicly so that there's going to be, you know, 100, 200, 300 negotiators in the room instead of the handful that we need to get things done. Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't help but think this morning of the Leverett's argument that Obama should have just gone to Tehran and shaken hands with the Ayatollah and said, now we're friends, now let's negotiate all of these other issues, Nixon goes to China style, because there was Netanyahu saying, oh, come on, you're going to make a nuclear deal with the Iranians who still give money to Hamas? You're going to make a nuclear deal with the Iranians who do 100 other things that I don't like? All of those issues should have to be resolved before we make any kind of nuclear deal with them, which is exactly what the Leverett's were saying would happen, right? That the other, all the other extraneous issues would be used to try to derail the centerpiece, which is the nuclear program. And I'm sorry, of course, I talked us right up to the break like I always do, but hold tight right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Reza Marashi from the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The first of these great workshops is in Orlando, Saturday, March 7th. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Reza Marashi on the line. He's from the National Iranian American Council. And we're talking about the nuclear negotiations with the Iranians and Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to the Congress this morning, etc. And before the break, I was leading to some form of a Jeopardy kind of question there about what do you think about Obama's strategy here, trying to put away the nuclear deal first, and then maybe as a first step toward ending the Cold War and normalizing relations with Iran, rather than going all out on the Nixon goes to China model and just putting the Cold War to bed first. And then maybe that would make negotiations like this much easier in that different context. What do you think?
Well, I think that while I understand where Obama's coming from and I acknowledge the domestic political constraints, I would like to think that we could walk and chew gum at the same time and discuss more than one issue at once. But, you know, having spent some time in the U.S. government, I also understand how the nuclear issue has become the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room that really preoccupies everybody else's attention, sucks all the air out of the room, and prevents folks from having the ability, the flexibility to address the other issues, regional security concerns, et cetera, et cetera. So, while I would like it if we did more, I'm happy we're just doing something at all, because there was a very long time, decades, where we were doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing is, actually, it's not that. We're doing nothing as far as talking with them, but George Bush fought an entire war for Iran, and their loyal sock puppets of the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, 2003 through 12 there, and or through 11, and seemingly now again. And that's the funny part about all this is even during, and you know, 2007, I would say, is probably the closest we came to war with Iran, when they were blaming Iran for everything bad that was happening in Iraq, when America was fighting as their spear tip in that entire battle against the Sunnis and driving them out of Baghdad and all that with the Badr Brigade. And I'm actually really worried about this, that, you know, we can't just stop threatening them. We have to actually you know, either do both at the same time, fight for them and against them at the same time, like in the Bush years, or there's been talk of Obama and Khamenei talking about, yeah, you know, once we get this nuclear deal done, then maybe we can work together against ISIS in Iraq. But of course, it's working for Iran and Iraq. That's what that's helped lead to the creation of ISIS to oppose us in the first place. And it seems like, I don't know what you guys' official position on that is, but I would hope that you guys are opposed to working with Iran on any alliance on a war against the Islamic State or anyone else. Can't we just have peace, you know, instead of fighting one way or the other?
I think that's the goal, you know. You know, the average Joes like you and I, it's easier for us to say that because we don't have to deal with the institutional constraints in the D.C. establishment. That being said, I try to be as fair as possible, and I give President Obama credit for doing something that zero of his predecessors have tried to do, which is take the political risks that are necessary to, you know, try and solve at least an aspect of this conflict, never mind the entire thing. And, you know, to be even more fair, I give the Iranians credit as well, because it's not just America that's reaching out and negotiating. The Iranians are doing so as well. So should we expect more than baby steps from our political leaders? Of course. Am I happy that we have baby steps instead of no steps at all? Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I'm talking about big steps the wrong direction. Like, hey, let's be friends and then go off to war together again.
Yeah, I don't think anybody wants a war here at the end of the day, at least none of us that are sane, because a war benefits nobody except extremists, and the extremists are always going to be in the minority. So taking whatever steps are necessary to prevent another armed conflict in the Middle East, I think, should be priority number one. And again, that's one of these points where I give Obama credit.
Right. Yeah, no, me too. And, you know, I think we've talked about this for a while. It's been, you know, a year and a half of negotiations here. Or more, whatever it is. And it's been kind of an open question of just how serious Obama is about getting this deal done. And even though, like I mentioned before, that he said, you know, and he said this numerous times, chances are probably 50-50 something. I'm not hanging my hat on it and whatever. I think that's just politics. I think he and John Kerry both have decided they really want to see this thing through. And it'll be a real disaster, a real failure on their part if they don't get it done. And especially because of the other thing you said, that clearly the Ayatollah and the president of Iran are way out on a limb on this thing, too. And they have really, you know, been willing to suck up a lot in order to, you know, given up their uranium stockpile and you know, even really negotiating under the terms of these sanctions, under the situation of these sanctions. It's a big political risk domestically for them, obviously, to do this. So all the more reason to think that Obama and Kerry ought to be able to do it. And it certainly looks at this late date like they mean to. And the leaks from all sides say that they don't foresee any more extensions at this point. They think they're going to wrap this up by the end of this month. Isn't that right?
That's the goal. That's what they're shooting for. And, you know, having a goal is positive. There's no guarantee that they'll be able to wrap up the political framework agreements that they're working on, but the last two meetings that they've had, one in Munich and one in Geneva, they made quite a bit of progress, according to their own words. And that kind of momentum is what you need to cross the finish line. So I remain cautiously optimistic.
All right. And then, so now what about your read on Congress? I mean, 50 Democrats didn't even show up, or they said they weren't going to. I don't know how many actually didn't show up at Netanyahu's speech this morning, and it has become a pretty controversial topic and even a partisan topic in Washington, D.C. So what do you think about the current state of Iran, of Congress's ability to end up scotching the deal somehow?
Well, Congress is going to have to play a pivotal role in any deal that is reached with the Iranians, because while Obama can negotiate the terms, if he negotiates terms that he knows are going to be a non-starter to Congress, then the deal is going to be dead on arrival, because Congress will have to actually help execute anything that the president signs. So Obama is going to take into account what the various interests of Congress are, and he's going to have some work that he's going to need to do in order to peel off members of Congress to support him instead of a foreign leader like the Israeli prime minister. But at the end of the day, I do think it's possible. It's going to require a lot of heavy lifting, and it's going to require a lot of political will. But the tangible benefits of getting this deal done are so obvious and so plainly clear as day that I think it will sell itself. And that's where we're at. So hopefully that's what will happen, you know, and but time will tell. Remains to be seen.
Yeah, you know, debating the deal before it's done is one thing. But if the president of the United States is saying, listen, I have this deal here, Congress, and I would like for you to not screw it up. That's kind of a whole different topic at that point. And, you know, if it comes to a president trying to start a war and Congress getting in his way, That's great, but when a president's trying to make peace, it seems like they better not, you know, obstruct. I think the politics there at that point will have shifted toward the president pretty far if he has a deal in hand. So, you know, I sure hope you're right. Seems like you are. But anyway, so thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us what you think, Rez. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you again. That's Reza Marashi. He's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org, NIAcouncil.org. And they have an official statement out here from, I guess, their president or director, Trita Parsi here, NIAC statement on Netanyahu's speech. You can find that on my Twitter feed or just at NIAcouncil.org. And then, so I got some news to catch up with you guys on. After this break, we got one more segment to wrap up the show today. But for now, I'll mention one more time, if you just go to scotthorton.org/Kickstarter, that'll lead you to the new Kickstarter project trying to raise $675. We've already got some pledges so far here. Thank you very much, everybody. We're trying to raise $675. Oh, we got $190 now out of $675 pledged. And the project is to pay the genius, and we've already hired him, to transfer the entire interview archive, 3,600-plus interviews, to YouTube. And so sure do appreciate y'all's support on that. Again, just go to scotthorton.org/Kickstarter, and we'll be right back in just a sec.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Wrapping up here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Again, scotthorton.org/Kickstarter. Thanks, everybody who's already pledged to help support. I'm kind of nervous. What's it going to be like to have 3,600-something interviews all on YouTube? Hopefully, it'll bring a bunch of new listeners to the show. That's my hope. I got $190 pledged so far. We're trying to raise $675. If you go to scotthorton.org/Kickstarter, there's a video there that's basically a segment of this show, me explaining what's going on. And so, yeah, thank you. Okay, now, I think we pretty much beat the Iran-Israel nuclear Netanyahu speech dead horse to death on the show today, right? Was there anything big that it didn't cover? I don't think so. But so, man, I got so many police state stories here that I need to talk with you about. We'll have plenty more on Iran for the rest of the week and Israel. But first of all, I mentioned this the other day, but it's really important to me. And I think objectively, somehow, it's just important. In fact, I reject the subjective theory of value when it comes to this subject. I think that even if all humans died and none of us were left to perceive anything at all, this would still be important. Did the FBI tamper with a witness in the Oklahoma City bombing evidence case? Yes, I have the emails to prove it. And what happened is that in the summer of 1995, federal agents tortured a man to death in a federal transfer facility in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His name was Kenneth Trenadue. And apparently, the reason that they did it is because they thought he was a man named Richard Guthrie that they were looking for, who very likely was John Doe number two, or if not the John Doe two, was one of Timothy McVeigh's associates in the lead-up to the Oklahoma City bombing on April the 19th, 1995. And the thing of it is that his brother's a lawyer, so he intervened in all the right ways with the legal paperwork and prevented the torturer murderers from cremating Kenneth Trenadue. And he got the body, and he proved that they tortured and murdered him. Well, he didn't prove who, but he won. The government ended up, I forget now if they settled or if it was a judgment against him, but they paid Jesse Trenadue more than $1 million for the pain and suffering and the wrongful death of his brother, some exact technicality. I forget exactly the ruling, but anyway, they did pay him, and they're guilty as hell, the feds. But anyway, the point being that that's how this Utah lawyer, Jesse Trenadue, got caught up in the story of the Oklahoma City bombing, because they murdered his brother in a case of mistaken identity in regards to the Oklahoma bombing. And so he's been suing their ass ever since then, and he's gotten a ton of documents out. And I got a page somewhere. Google my name and OKC documents, and it may come up. I don't know. I'm going to get that straight here real soon. But Bob McCarty, I don't see eye to eye with him on a lot of things, but he's got a great archive of these articles. Mother Jones has a great piece by James Ridgway and a ton of PDF articles. You know, if you lean left and you don't like what sounds like some kind of right-wing conspiracy theory here or whatever, go read James Ridgway about it at Mother Jones Magazine. And the point of it is that McVeigh was not a militia guy. He was a neo-Nazi. And all of his neo-Nazi buddies were all compromised by the government in some way. But of course, that also meant that the government was very compromised too. And what I mean is they were informants, or, you know, like flipped states witnesses and this kind of thing. And yet, on the other hand, seems like one of their leaders, Andre Karl Strassmeier, was a German army intelligence officer. Seemed like he wasn't really a Nazi at all, that he was undercover working for, I'm not exactly certain which or which all agencies, to infiltrate this group and provoke them into doing something horrible. And anyway, you know, Danny Colson, the FBI, says he thinks there's something to that, too. But anyway, so Jesse Trenadue has been suing the hell out of these guys. And recently the case is he wants the footage that he knows they have and that they claim that they don't have or can't find. And that is the surveillance footage of the bombing, McVeigh and his accomplice getting out of the Yellow Rider truck, not just McVeigh, etc. And the FBI has been dragging their feet and obstructing and doing everything they can to not tell the truth about this for years now. And there's this judge named Wadoops, or Wadoops, I don't know, Judge Clark Wadoops. And he hadn't been taking this S from them this whole time. He keeps finding them almost in contempt. You better bring me the documents, I said, and that kind of attitude, which, you know, kind of like that ambition made to counteract ambition sort of thing, working in our favor in this case. And what it comes down to here is that Jesse Trenadue has a source who was an FBI asset during the days of PatCon, which was the FBI's infiltrate the radical right operation in the early and mid-1990s, and that this guy has, I forget now what the hell it was that he testified to Jesse. He's given Jesse a ton of information about, I guess, these Nazis in the PatCon operation and all this. But then we got the proof in the emails that an FBI agent had advised him to not testify. When he was going to testify, he didn't want to testify, but was going to. And I don't know why the judge doesn't just subpoena the man. I don't know the rules on all of that kind of thing. But anyway, you know, I have myself in the files. I got the PDFs that Jesse sent me of the emails of the FBI agent telling this guy to not go to the trial. So, you know, yes, they're guilty of jury tampering and or witness tampering and telling this guy not to go. But, of course, they're the FBI, so the law doesn't really apply to them in a criminal kind of way, but the judge can use it to whoop their ass and at least hold them in contempt and yell at them and make for headlines and stuff for us and that kind of thing. But, you know, I think if you just read this brief article at Fox13Now.com, which is Salt Lake City's Fox affiliate, Fox13Now.com, Trenadue, is the name, and the article is actually, did the FBI tamper with a witness in the OKC bombing evidence case? I think, you know, even if you've never read about this at all before, this would be a nice little introduction to this story, and get your mind reeling, I hope. A lot to be learned there. And now, moving on, sorry, I'm trying to hurry, but I'm not doing a very good job of it. This is real. This is not a lie. Man gets life in prison for selling $20 worth of weed to an undercover cop. Not in authoritarian Russia, not in theocratic Iran or in communist China, in America. In America. A man got life in prison, and then just, it's, the story's in the headline. He sold it to an undercover cop. Well, he didn't even sell it. He scored it. He didn't have any weed. He was just some bum. And the cop told him, if you'll get me a $20 bag of weed, I'll give you a $5 finder fee so you can get something to eat. And the bum said, oh, okay, and went around the corner and got the guy a bag. But he wasn't even the guy who goes around the corner and gets a guy a bag. He was just some bum. Entrapped by a cop into selling a quarter bag, a quarter ounce of pot. Life in prison. With hard labor. Oh, good. In Shreveport, Louisiana. This is at boingboing.net. Real, not a lie. Well, listen, we don't want to send the wrong message to the children that marijuana is okay. And so, if this pathetic bum has to do the rest of his life at hard labor for being entrapped into selling a quarter ounce of pot to an undercover cop, then good. What? He only gets one life and this is it? Oh, well, screw him, because we don't want to send the wrong message to the children. You know, we'd hate for them to pick up a lesson like it's perfectly okay to throw someone's life away if you want to send a message to someone else. It's a very important lesson for children to learn, you know? About drug use. Can you imagine? Entrapped into selling a dime bag, basically. And then, remember the one where the Ohio cop shot Tamir Rice? Was it Cleveland, Ohio? Shot 12-year-old boy Tamir Rice. They lie their ass off about it, but then the surveillance footage shows the truth, and they're being sued, and they said that the boy is responsible for his own death. The boy and his family are directly caused by their own acts, because Tamir, this 12-year-old boy, failed to exercise due care. You know, he should have done the Matrix and dodged the bullet that the cops were shooting at him. Really? And I can't believe I'm already out of time for this segment. Oklahoma City, man. Anyway, tomorrow I got a ton of cop stories for you guys. Thanks for listening.